to hold a general election on December 12th, then the EU probably goes ahead and approves a three-month extension that would give time both for the election and for some time afterwards to kind of figure out the results and see where they're at. They will definitely do a flex tension, meaning that let's say there was an election December 12th and they agreed the Brexit deal right after that, then Brexit could happen at the end of the year. We don't have to wait until January 31st. The French may want to go further than that. They may want to say, okay, we're granting an extension. On paper, this extension is only until November 15th, but it automatically rolls over and continues until January 31st if there's no agreement by then. Now, if there isn't an election, if there isn't a vote to hold an election, then we're not really sure. Then France probably will only want a short-term extension until November 15th in order just to say, okay, this is only for you to approve the deal, because France has always said, we can't grant an extension for no reason. There has to be something material that can change. There has to be a general election or a second referendum. And if they don't have that plan for a general election in the UK, France does not want to grant a long-term extension.
Mm. Now, what will the EU do if the UK decides to hold a second referendum?
Yeah, this is the other spanner in the works that could be thrown in here. If somehow over the course of the next week it ends up that either we don't have a general election but do have a second referendum, or let's say they hold an election, Labour and the Liberal Democrats come to power and they say, okay, we're holding a second referendum. The question is, that will take a long time under the law. I believe it's 4 months that needs to be granted before the referendum would be held. That campaign would take 4 months. So really you would need a 6-month extension in order to hold that. There is a question over whether the EU would grant such a long extension. Although really talking to people here in Brussels, it does sound like they would grant that extension. There would be a lot of frustration about it, a lot of feeling that Brexit is never ending. But there is a feeling in Brussels that the first referendum in 2016 was not a fair democratic exercise, that the question was too vague and that people didn't really know what they were voting on. And so the EU doesn't want to be seen to be standing in the way of a more correct democratic exercise for a second referendum. So the feeling is they probably would not block that, and they would grant a long extension of 6 months or a year in order to hold that referendum. But of course, that just continues the Brexit limbo even longer, something that people here would not be thrilled with.
Thank you very much for bringing us up to date on the Brexit saga. That was Dave Keating on the line from Brussels.
International report.
In Lebanon, anti-government protests are now entering their ninth day, with demonstrators demanding a complete overhaul of the political system. Anger over the government's inefficiency and corruption came into sharp relief last week when wildfires raged through the country and the government failed to mobilise to tackle them. Then the proposed tax on messaging apps days later was simply the straw that broke the camel's back. Prime Minister Saeed Hariri on Monday presented a package of reforms, including cutting ministerial salaries, but the rallies have continued, crippling Beirut and other major cities. Although Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, announced on Thursday that he would meet with protesters, this is unlikely to calm the atmosphere. Banks, schools and universities remained closed, and students and teachers are now holding special protest classes in a repurposed iconic building in Beirut called The Egg. Our correspondent Leila Molana Allen reports on this latest development.
When you're looking for spots to shut down and to close down traffic, one thing to keep in mind is to not antagonize necessarily the kind of bits of the population that might be from kind of disproportionately underprivileged backgrounds and actually need to circulate and might like not survive if they don't. This is just something to keep in mind also from the Egyptian experience, where the majority of the population at some point got massively against the protesters for having completely paralyzed the country.
This is a classroom, but not as you know it, because this is the classroom of the streets. For more than a week, protesters across Lebanon have taken to the streets to demand the downfall of the government and an end to corrupt politics. In a country that is one of the most unequal in the world, they want to stop the siphoning off of state funds to private interests, remove nepotistic monopolies that drive up prices for services like telecommunications, and divert funding to improve woefully inadequate services like electricity and create more job opportunities. Banks, universities and many other businesses have been closed since the protests began, But when the government announced that universities would reopen on Wednesday, professors at the American University of Beirut, AUB, released an open letter saying they would not go back to their classrooms in solidarity with calls for a national general strike. Instead, they said, they would hold non-mandatory seminars on contemporary political action for students at the center of the Beirut protests. Instead, they said, they would hold non-mandatory seminars on contemporary political action for students at the center of the Beirut protests. AUB art history professor Angela Harutyunyan is one of them.
The impetus came from the need to consolidate various propositions, to create a space for political and public debate that is not outside of the streets, that is in the street, but yet provides a space for quiet discussion, if that's possible here. And also being close to the street in a way that we could also join when we are needed there as bodies, as numbers, simply.
She believes being a part of the protests is a vital life lesson for her students.
My answer and my kind of urge to the parents would be to let them experience, to let them learn from the unfolding events. That's a much better school than learning, you know, some professions and going into a job market that is almost non-existent.
Looking for a space for the sessions, they decided the building known as The Egg, in the heart of downtown Beirut, would be the most symbolic. A former cinema that has stood destroyed since the end of the Civil War in 1990, the domed concrete structure poses a stark contrast to the manicured, rebuilt surroundings of wealthy downtown, and is usually closed to the public. AUB students reacted to the decision to reopen the universities with similar opposition. They protested around the university gate for 6 hours into the night after the decision was announced on Tuesday, blocking off the roads until the university's principal agreed to suspend classes until further notice. Now they hope students and professors from other universities in Lebanon will join them at the Egg Classroom, dubbed the Eggupation, to organize themselves in united action and bring about long-lasting change. Yasmina Tabal is a 22-year-old art student at AUB.
Due to the revolt, what happened is that the university decided for safety reasons to cancel school for a few days. Having done that, students have gone to the streets and realized what their power is in this revolution, and they realized that this is the most important generation to be on the streets today, because our parents have been fighting this fight for 30 years and are bordering hopeless. As a result, we have to carry that burden for them.
Yasmina hopes the impromptu revolutionary classroom will help her and fellow students understand how best to make their voices heard and force the government to make the changes protesters demand.
The universities want us to choose between our education and what's happening on the street, our duty as citizens, our duty as the youth. And we're realizing now that the students have the power to mobilize everything, to close everything. Professors, specifically AUB professors, are realizing how important the occupation of space, physical space, especially in a place as gentrified as Beirut, with the biggest economic gap, is important. But it is being used as a place in central Beirut to hold a discourse about what strategies can be built and to mobilize in an effective way at the heart of Beirut instead of in our secluded university classrooms.
I don't mean to hog the mic, but I want to say something for students. I think students are deeply underestimating the power they have. They don't have the hope we have. AUB and AUB students.
That was our correspondent Leila Molena Allen reporting from Beirut in Lebanon.
Focus on Africa.
Staying with anti-government protests, but this time in Guinea, thousands of people have taken to the streets in the capital Conakry to contest the president's bid for a third term. Unlike smaller earlier demonstrations, which saw some 9 people killed and several opposition leaders jailed, yesterday's march was mostly peaceful. But the situation remains volatile, with more demonstrations planned. President Alpha Condé has accused the organisers of stirring up trouble and scaring investors away. He himself was in Sochi yesterday, the first Russia-Africa summit, reassuring Moscow that Guinea is open for business. RFI's Christina Okello looks at what's driving these protests.
Saying no to a third term for President Alpha Condé. The 81-year-old has neither denied or confirmed whether he'll run again in next year's presidential race. His mandate is meant to expire in December 2020. But the fact that he's even asked his government to look into drafting a new constitution has raised fears that he will reset the button on his presidency.
Those Science Radio for Newar.
The biological changes in mothers after childbirth are very significant and important. But for some parents, this postpartum period can lead to a type of depression, thought to be associated with drastic changes in hormone levels. Dr. Peter Schmidt at the National Institute of Mental Health says postpartum depression is estimated to affect roughly 13% of all new mothers.
So each year in the United States, there's approximately 500,000 women who are at risk for developing postpartum depression. So clearly this is an important condition to the public health of this country. These are prevalent conditions and associated with considerable morbidity.
Many women, probably at least 50%, experience what are called the baby blues for a week or two after giving birth.
Kathleen O'Leary is with the Women's Mental Health Program at NIMH. She explains that women may feel tearful, emotionally very sensitive, overwhelmed, or just not like themselves.
And this is not unusual. If these symptoms go on for more than 2 weeks or become more intense, or women start experiencing some of the other symptoms of depression, then they should really seek help.
Symptoms of depression can vary depending on the individual, but can include sad, anxious, or empty feelings, feelings of hopelessness, pessimism, or worthlessness. O'Leary adds that what starts out as sleep deprivation issues for new mothers can transform into the more serious problems of depression.
If someone feels that they would be better off dead, or that others would be better off without them, then that is the most serious sign that means that a medical professional needs to be consulted about this as soon as possible.
Research has shown some women are at greater risk of experiencing postpartum depression. That includes women who have had postpartum depression with a previous child, women who have had depression, whether treated or untreated, at another time in their lives, as well as women who have bipolar disorder. NIMH investigators have conducted extensive research into postpartum depression, its causes, and possible treatments. Dr. Schmidt explains that current research includes the indication that estradiol, a form of estrogen, has a rapid antidepressant effect on women with postpartum depression.
Because of our earlier work, it suggested that declining levels of estrogen during the postpartum around delivery might contribute to triggering the onset of depression. And there had been some preliminary open trials showing that estradiol may have an effective antidepressant action in some of these women. So we have a study now in which we're using estradiol, physiologic levels, so comparable to what a woman would be exposed to during her normal cycle. And we give that in a controlled trial to women who have current postpartum depression.
The possibility of successful hormone treatment along with effective therapy has been very encouraging for many women. For more information on postpartum depression and NIMH research on depression, visit www.nimh.nih.gov. This is Joe Belinfi, National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
My report is about Alexandra Scott. She opened a lemonade stand to raise money to fight cancer.
Lemonade.
Her friends all over the country wanted to help. They raised over $1 million before Alex died of her own cancer. Life gave Alex a lemon, but she made lemonade.
Inspiration.
Lemonade.
Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
If you've got a story to tell, I'd like to hear you on the radio. Email steve@radionewark.org.
Radio Newark.
Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for December 1st, 2006. This week, we're celebrating the Science Update Podcast's first birthday.
Happy!
In this episode, Justin Warner is going to tell us whether colors are the same across cultures, and Chelsea Wald will answer a listener's question about the physics of the early universe. What's more, we're going to play some birthday wishes from our science podcasting friends and tell you how to send some wishes of your own and win a coveted Smarten Up mug. More details coming up.
Hello, I'm Caroline Williams in London.
And I'm Ivan Semenek in Boston.
And we're the hosts of SciPod, the international science podcast from New Scientist magazine.
Caroline, can it really be that the Science Update podcast is one full year old?
Apparently it can.
Wow. I remember when we had our first anniversary. Those were the days.
Actually, it was just a month ago.
Oh, yeah. You know, I still think we have some champagne left over. Hang on. Yeah, here it is right here.
Oh, look, I've got one too.
Perfect. Okay, well, now we can give you a proper toast, Science Update. So,
from all your friends at New Scientist,
on both sides of the Atlantic,
we wish you a happy anniversary.
And don't forget to tune into SciPod.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Well, if you've got kids and you don't keep them hermetically sealed, you've probably had a run-in with head lice. I sure have. In fact, 5 years ago, when my 8-year-old daughter came back from camp with them, I shaved my head to avoid them. Now, there's a lot of excitement about a new, less drastic way to control the little cooties. Chelsea has more.
Well, this is a preview of what you'll hear if you're ever treated with the Louse Buster, a new hairdryer-like device that kills head lice by drying them out with air. Its inventor, Dale Clayton, is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Utah. He says one of the major problems with available shampoo treatments is that lice quickly evolve resistance to the chemicals.
Evolving resistance to chemicals like pyrethrin is actually fairly easy for insects to do. The pathways are quite similar to those involved in DDT resistance, in fact. But how would you evolve the ability to greatly reduce the need for water? That would be very complicated. And I've talked to a lot of my insect physiologist colleagues, and they basically say no way.
It's for this reason that he's calling the Louse Buster evolution-proof. Sadly, the Louse Buster isn't yet available, and simply using a hairdryer won't work and could even be dangerous. So for now, knit combs and special shampoos are the only effective solutions.
Hi, this is Chris Kendian with the American Society for Microbiology and the Microworld Radio Podcast, and I just want to wish Science Update a very happy first-year birthday. Keep up the good work, guys.
NASA recently announced that it will service the Hubble Space Telescope one more time, meaning we'll have 7 more years of its stunning images. But what comes after that? All eyes are on the James Webb Space Telescope, which will have a mirror 7 times larger than Hubble's. It's designed to look at the youngest galaxies in the universe and see how planets form. Pam Sullivan, a manager for the telescope, says NASA engineers are already hard at work.
2006 is actually the big year for us in that we're trying to demonstrate all of our technologies. We've got 10 what we call enabling technologies, things that have to work, things that we have to invent, basically, for the James Webb Space Telescope to work. We're on track to finish up that this year.
If things go according to plan, the JWST will launch in 2013, just in time to take over from Hubble.
Hi, this is Kirsten from This Week in Science, and I'd like to wish Science Update a very happy birthday.
Next, getting all the cultures in the world to agree on anything may sound like an impossible diplomatic stunt, but some things are truly universal. Justin has this story.
Gertrude Stein famously said, "Rose is a rose is a rose." Now, psychologists Delwyn Lindsay and Angela Brown of The Ohio State University have proven that red is red is red. They found that speakers of 110 different languages all classify colors according to their place in the rainbow. In other words, Lindsay explains that a non-English speaker's word for red would include shades like burgundy, brick, and cherry, just like our own red.
Perhaps their sample might extend a little bit into the pinks and a little bit into the oranges, but they certainly would not, for example, have a color name that would span 2 entirely different categories.
He also notes that industrialized countries tend to have far more color names than indigenous cultures, and that's no accident.
In very traditional cultures in which objects within that culture could be defined on the basis or identified on the basis of a number of different kinds of features, that they would tend to use or have relatively few basic color terms. But as that culture advanced technologically, so would its capacity to make artifacts or objects that could be distinguished solely on the basis of color.
Still, even cultures with only 2 different color names split the spectrum down the middle into warm versus cool hues, which suggests that color distinctions arise from our brains and not our cultures.
This is Mignon Fogarty from Absolute Science. Happy birthday, Science Update Podcast.
slow, restless moan is the song of an Antarctic iceberg, sped up so humans can hear it. Northwestern University seismologist Emil O'Call and his colleagues are studying these strange, ultra-low-frequency melodies with seismic microphones they've planted on the ice. O'Call says each iceberg resonates in a surprisingly specific note, which fluctuates over time.
And this creates a kind of symphony, like, you know, if you slightly adjust the length of a violin string, you're going to be able to slightly change the musical note that you play.
It's not clear where the rumbling comes from. O'Call says it may be the sound of icebergs scraping together, or the vibrations of water flowing through cracks like air through an organ pipe. He says figuring out what these songs are and understanding why an iceberg might change its tune could help scientists keep tabs on the shrinking polar ice.
Hey, this is Carrie Grenz of the Week from The Scientist. Happy birthday!
This is Stuart Wills, the host of the Science Magazine podcast, with a big happy first birthday to AAAS's Science Update podcast.
Finally, Chelsea answers a listener's question about the physics of the early universe.
Well, this is a hard one, but listener Chuck London wrote from York, Pennsylvania, to ask whether physics worked differently when the universe was young, before the first stars, and certainly before the first physicists. Well, Stefan Alexander of Penn State says, yes, it's likely that the rules governing particles and forces changed soon after the Big Bang, but scientists haven't come up with a theory that goes back that far. However, he says they're hoping to find a connection between this early era and another great physics mystery, dark energy.
Dark energy could actually be a consequence of, we expect it to be a consequence of some yet unknown physics or law in the early universe.
And, of course, if you're mystified by a science question, call us at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT or submit it at scienceupdate.com. If we use it in the podcast, you'll win a Science Update mug.
Hi, this is Aaron Price from the Slacker Astronomy Podcast, and I'd like to congratulate the hardworking Science Update staff on a wonderful year. Happy birthday.
And if you want to win a Science Update mug but can't think of a question, you can win one this week only by sending us a birthday wish. Call us at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT and leave your brief birthday message along with your name and where you live. Like, hey, this is Julie from Poughkeepsie, New York, and I just want to say happy birthday, but something more creative than that. Then leave your address, which of course we will not put on the podcast. We'll include as many birthday wishes as we can in our next episode, and the first five well-wishers will get Science Update mugs.
Happy, happy love, you've been sent from up above.
And a very emphatic thank you to all our podcasting friends for sending birthday shout-outs. If you'd like to know more about any of these podcasters, you can find links to them on scienceupdate.com/podcast.php right on our website. The happy birthday song in this episode comes from artist Cremo, whose song we found at the Podshow Podsafe Music Network. Please check him out. Next time, we'll talk about why malaria parasites are regaining susceptibility to an old drug that's been all but abandoned, and answer a listener's question about why more things aren't dimpled like golf balls. In the meantime, don't forget to come visit us at scienceupdate.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.
IZU 99.9.
Question of the Week from the Naked Scientists.
Hello, and welcome to the Naked Scientists podcast with me, Caris Lestrange. This week, we're answering this electrifying question from Anders.
Why do power lines make so much noise?
On Facebook, Rachel speculates that it's when there's too much electricity and some tries to escape, whereas Henry thinks it's down to vibrations, or as Stephen said, good vibrations. Meanwhile, Andrew Griffiths is a semiconductor engineer from the company IQE.
In power lines themselves, the noise is usually due to something called a coronal discharge, which is when the electric field is strong enough to make the surrounding air conduct. The sound you're hearing is a transfer of energy from the power line to the surrounding air. Designers of power lines want to avoid this noise as it results in a power loss, but it's partially dependent on atmospheric conditions such as the air pressure and humidity. For example, if it rains, the noise can become louder due to the increased humidity and addition of water droplets on the surface of the wires. This creates a more conductive environment. The corona discharge and therefore the noise can be reduced by making sure the power lines are thicker and the spacing between the power lines is sufficient. This energy loss can also be reduced by decreasing the voltage. However, if we decrease the voltage, the current then increases. This increased current causes more power loss due to heating, so you have to balance how much energy high voltage loses in noisy corona discharge and how much low voltage transmission would lose in heat.
But why does the discharge produce a steady buzzing sound?
Electricity is distributed to homes via alternating current. Alternating current is where electric current moves backwards and forwards at 50 times a second. Any noise that you hear in power lines or transformers is associated with this frequency.
So the noise is a 50 hertz buzz produced as the voltage rises and falls in the cable 50 times per second. But what causes the voltage and current to alternate like this in the first place?
Domestic electricity is generated by a process called electromagnetic induction, which converts movement into electricity. It does this by rotating a magnet relative to some wires. As the magnet turns, the voltage goes positive and negative because of how the wires are set up. This positive and negative change in voltage pushes and pulls the current in two directions.
Rachel on Facebook was along the right lines then, saying that the electricity was trying to escape. But it looks as though these good vibrations are here to stay. Thank you to Andrew Griffiths from IQE for that answer. Next week, we're hitting the road for Marco.
I was driving my truck, pulling a 53-foot trailer, and it blew over due to a strong wind. I was wondering if you could work out the wind speed so that I know when to stop driving.
If you know the answer to this question, or if you have a question for us, you can email chris@thenakedscientist.com, find us on Facebook, tweet @NakedScientists, or join the debate on the forum, thenakedscientists.com/forum. That's all for now. Until next time, goodbye.
Question of the Week is part of the Naked Scientists podcast and supported by the Wellcome Trust and UK Fast. Look us up online at nakedscientists.com.
This is Radio Newark.
Radio Newark News.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. 45 million people in southern Africa are expected to face severe food insecurity in the next 6 months as the worst drought in decades continues to bite, the World Food Programme has warned. In an attempt to boost aid efforts and international awareness ahead of the lean season, WFP said that the 16-nation region has seen normal rainfall in just one of the last five growing seasons. On top of that, back-to-back cyclones and flooding have destroyed harvests and left communities even more vulnerable. Nine countries are of particular concern: Angola, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Zambia, Madagascar, Malawi, Namibia, Eswatini and Lesotho. The agency's Margaret Malu, who's the acting regional director for Southern Africa, has called for help to meet the emergency food and nutrition needs of millions of people. She also wants investment to help people withstand ever more frequent and severe droughts, floods and storms. In addition to providing help to 11 million people by the middle of next year, UN agencies also plan to help farmers boost production by managing soil and water resources better in the face of climate change, as well as leading livestock vaccination campaigns. According to the International Panel on Climate Change, Southern Africa's temperatures are rising at twice the global average. A Palestinian hunger striker who was held in solitary confinement in Israel for more than a month should be released immediately, UN-appointed independent rights experts said on Thursday. In a statement, the six experts said that Heba al-Labadi was arrested by Israeli soldiers in Jenin in the West Bank in late August. She then faced 30 days of interrogation for up to 20 hours a day, they say, before being sentenced to 5 months' detention without being told the charges or evidence against her. Following sentencing, Ms. al-Labadi launched a hunger strike, which is in its sixth week. She was transferred to hospital last Sunday, suffering from several medical conditions. In an appeal to the Israeli authorities to free her, the rights experts highlighted that while administrative detention is not prohibited under international law, its widespread use in Israel was incompatible with international humanitarian law and international human rights law. Cities are home to more than half of the people on Earth, 40 million of whom die every year from heart disease, cancer, diabetes and lung disease. Now, in a bid to tackle these preventable conditions and take on another urban killer, road accidents, the UN Health Agency has come up with a 10-point blueprint for safe cities. It's been inspired by successful policies already in place around the world, from smoke-free measures in Bogor, Indonesia, to road safety initiatives in Ghana's Accra. A walkable streets plan in New York City is also highlighted by the World Health Organization, which says that it reduced elderly pedestrian fatalities by 16%. The report was supported by WHO Global Ambassador and former long-term New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. It highlights how cities in the developing world are where 85% of all non-communicable disease deaths happen and where almost all fatal road traffic accidents occur. WHO researchers say that the economic benefits for low- and middle-income countries could be at least $350 billion. Under the UN-led 2030 agenda, more than 190 countries have committed to reducing premature deaths from non-communicable diseases by a third in the next decade and to halving road traffic deaths and injuries by 2020. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
The 90-Second Naturalist.
Hi there, I'm Thane Maynard. You probably used to think that if you've seen one cardinal, you've seen them all. But then the internet lit up this year with a bright yellow cardinal down in Alabama. Holy cow. Ornithologists from Auburn University said that the bird probably has a genetic mutation that renders the pigments it draws from food yellow rather than red. The condition, xanthochroism, has been seen in other cardinals, along with eastern house finches and evening grosbeaks. Other experts pointed out that the cardinal's crest and wing feathers look frayed. While wear and tear is a natural part of a bird's life, it can be exacerbated by a poor diet or environmental stressors. These health issues could lead to changes in how carotenoids, plant-based pigments that turn feathers red, orange, and yellow, are expressed. The only way to conclusively solve the case is to wait for the cardinal to molt its feathers. If it is still yellow next winter, a mutation is the likeliest culprit. But if it comes out red after another molt, it means the bird somehow recalibrated its pigment.
The 90-Second Naturalist is brought to you by the Gehring Center for Family and Private Business, a valued partner delivering knowledge, connection, and community. As part of the Lindner College of Business at the University of Cincinnati, the Gehring Center has been helping drive a vibrant regional economy since 1989.
Science Radio for Newark, Delaware.
All right, class. Let's hear what everyone did this weekend. Jill?
Well, I raised my older sister to a big oak tree. It was at least 100 years old. My mom said I must have set a record or something. And then we went down by a stream and perched up on this huge rock and saw all of these little minnows swimming around way below us. And then I rescued my little brother from an evil slug king who was guarding him in the bush fortress. And my sister and I brought him back to our super twig fort for safety. And then we all laid out and told stories until it got dark. And the Big Dipper led us all the way home.
Awesome.
Where were you, Jill?
Yeah.
We went to the forest. It's not that far away. Anyone want to come this weekend?
Ask your parents to take you and your friends to the forest this week and find the fun, adventurous you. It's closer than you think. Check out discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Hi, my name is Ken Chisholm. I'm the director of the Science Working Group at Radio Newark. I'm retired now, but I spent my career in the chemical industry after obtaining university degrees in forestry, botany, and biochemistry. At Radio Newark, we're always on the lookout for people who have an interest in communicating stories related to science. There are so many stories right here in Newark. If you have a story, or you're interested in learning how to produce them, contact us at www.radionewark.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Thank you and have a good day.
Science!
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. This is Rick Pettigrew to tell you about a fresh batch of stories in the audio news from Archaeologica. Each week, we select four of the best stories posted online by our partner, Archaeologica.org. Please go to the Archaeology Channel Facebook page and tell us what you think, or post a message on our social networking site, ArchaeoSeek. A Japanese tomb structure from the 6th century has an unusual stepped pyramid design. A new study tells us that mummification began in Egypt more than 1,000 years earlier than previously thought. Archaeologists in northern Greece are opening a vast tomb that apparently holds an associate of Alexander the Great. And two Maya cities have emerged from the dense forest of Mexico's Yucatan. Please remember that we couldn't do this show without a little help from our friends, so we're really grateful to our supporting members. If you like this show and are not already a member, please get on board and send us some support. Go to archaeologychannel.org and participate in our membership program. And if you'd like to become a sponsor, email us at info@archaeologychannel.org. And now, here's Laura Pettigrew with the audio news from Archaeologica. We hope you find this to be a valuable part of your day.
Welcome to the audio news from Archaeologica. I'm Laura Pettigrew, and these are the headlines in archaeological and historical news from August 10th to August 16th, 2014. In our first story, an ancient burial mound shaped like a step pyramid is a new and unusual discovery for Japanese archaeology. As reported in the Asahi Shimbun newspaper, the Miyakozuka tomb in the Nara prefecture, which is believed to date from the latter half of the 6th century, is a square-shaped tumulus built of stones arranged into stepped levels like stairs. According to the research team from Kansai University and the local school system, the scale of the site is comparable to the burial grounds of emperors, and it appears to have housed a powerful member of the Soga clan. One likely candidate for ownership is Soga no Iname, a statesman who married his daughters off to an emperor. He also gained tremendous power from his control of immigrants from China and Korea, who brought cultural and technological advances with them to Japan. At its base, the tumulus is about 41 meters square, or nearly 140 feet, with a height of more than 4.5 meters, or 15 feet. A previous survey of the site by Kansai University in 1967 noted only that it might be circular or square in shape, and was unable to identify the stepped construction. The new team has now determined that the structure has more than 5 stepped levels, each 30 to 60 centimeters high and roughly 1 meter wide. The steps are made of stones packed with soil. The structure is similar to those found in the ancient kingdom of Koguryo, which held sway over northeastern China and the northern part of the Korean peninsula. The area around the Miyakozuka tomb is one of the strongholds of the Soga clan. Soga no Iname brought the Soga clan to prominence and prosperity. His son Umako is believed to have been buried in the Ishibutai tomb nearby, constructed in the first half of the 7th century. We travel now to the United Kingdom, where new evidence suggests that the ancient Egyptian art of making mummies started 1,500 years earlier than previously thought. After an 11-year study, an international team from Australia and the United Kingdom has found biochemical traces of mummification agents in burials predating the previously earliest known mummies by over a millennium. Traditional thinking on mummification holds that it started in the later part of the Old Kingdom, around 2200 BC, and did not become widespread until the Middle Kingdom, 2200 to 1600 BC. It was believed that the practice arose following people's observations during the late Neolithic and pre-dynastic periods between 4500 and 31 BC that bodies dried out naturally through burial in hot, dry desert sand. Now, however, this international interdisciplinary team has identified the presence of complex embalming agents in the Neolithic era. The chemical traces came from linen wrappings used on bodies in one of the earliest recorded ancient Egyptian cemeteries at Mostaghedda in the region of Upper Egypt. The path to the new discoveries began in 2002 when Dr. Jana Jones of Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia, started chasing down the facts behind old reports on the methods of wrapping bodies at the Neolithic cemeteries in Badari and Mostaghedda. Jones began scrutinizing samples of the funerary textiles excavated from these sites in the 1930s, which had been distributed to various museums. Microscopic analysis suggested the likely use of rosins, but Jones could not confirm his theories or their full significance without more detailed knowledge of their chemical and physical composition. Jones recruited the expertise of Dr. Stephen Buckley, a research fellow at the University of York in the UK, who studies ancient organic compounds. They both knew that their challenge to the traditional date for the beginning of mummification would be controversial without conclusive biochemical evidence, which Dr. Buckley agreed to pursue. Buckley's previous research has identified many organic compounds from archaeological contexts that are not often seen in literature or widely used in mass spectra libraries. Buckley deployed a combination of gas chromatography mass spectrometry and sequential thermal desorption and pyrolysis technologies on the fragments of funerary textiles. The results identified the traces of multiple chemicals applied to the burial wrappings: a pine rosin, an aromatic plant extract, a plant gum or sugar, a natural petroleum source, and a plant oil or animal fat. These embalming agents are from the 4th millennium BC, more than a millennium older than the previous earliest scientific evidence of mummification. Some of the ingredients have antibacterial properties, while others would have provided for localized soft tissue preservation. Even more, their use in combination shows the use of complex recipes combining the same natural products in similar proportions as those employed at the peak of pharaonic mummification some 3,000 years later. The discovery in Neolithic burials shows the beginning of experimentation that would slowly and steadily evolve into one of the most famous aspects of ancient Egypt. The team also called upon the skills of Oxford University professor Thomas Higgum, who confirmed the date of the early burials. According to Higgum, the use of new scientific tools changed our knowledge about one of the most important facts of ancient Egypt. But more than that, it also demonstrates the huge potential of material in museum collections to allow researchers to unearth new information about the archaeological past. As Sydney's Dr. Jones summed it up, the research was a groundbreaking way to show just what can be achieved through interdisciplinary collaboration between the sciences and the humanities. Our next story comes to us from Greece, where archaeologists are preparing to open a vast ancient tomb distinguished by two sphinxes and frescoed walls and dated to the era of Alexander, 300 to 325 BC. Located in the country's northeastern Macedonian region, the tomb has been gradually unearthed over the past 2 years, providing a significant discovery from the early Hellenistic era. Some speculate the tomb may belong to Alexander himself or a member of his family. Alexander, who emerged from the northern Greek region of Macedonia to build an empire stretching as far as India, died in 323 BC and was laid to rest in Egypt. His fellow royals were traditionally interred in a cemetery in Macedonia near Vergina, far to the west, where the lavishly furnished tomb of Alexander's father, Philip II, was discovered in the 1970s. However, archaeologists believe that the apparently unlooted grave at Amphipolis, surrounded by a surprisingly long and well-built wall with courses of marble decorations, may have belonged to a senior ancient official. According to the excavation team leader, Katerina Peristeri, the mound may have been topped originally by a large stone lion that was found a century ago some 5 kilometers or 3 miles away. In Alexander's time, the lion was associated with Laomedon of Mytilene, one of Alexander's military commanders who became governor of Syria after the king's death. So far, workers have unveiled a flight of 13 steps leading to a broad path flanked by masonry walls, which ends in an arch showing two headless, wingless sphinxes, mythical creatures that blend human, bird, and lion characteristics. The tomb is expected to be opened in the next 2 weeks, and researchers will be eagerly awaiting evidence to indicate who was buried inside. We conclude our tour through the week's headlines in archaeology in Mexico, where pyramid temples and palace remains are emerging from the jungle covering two ancient Maya cities. Located in the southeastern part of the state of Campeche, in the heart of the Yucatan Peninsula, the cities were hidden in thick vegetation and barely accessible. According to expedition leader Ivan Sprague of the Research Center of the Slovenian Academy of Sciences and Arts, aerial photographs assisted in locating the sites. Sprague and his team found the massive remains as they further explored the area around Choctun, a large Maya city he discovered in 2013. No other site to date has been located in this area, which covers over some 1,800 square miles between the so-called Rio Bec and Chenes regions. Both areas are known for their characteristic architectural styles from the late Classic and terminal Classic periods, around AD 600 to 1000. One of the cities featured an extraordinary portico with an entrance representing the open jaws of an earth monster. The site previously was visited in the 1970s by the American archaeologist Eric Von Yu, who documented the portico and other stone monuments with yet unpublished drawings. However, the exact location of the city, which Von Yu called Lagunita, remained a mystery, as all attempts at relocating it failed. In an interview with Discovery News, Sprague said the correspondence with Lagunita was confirmed only after he compared the newly found portico with monuments from Von Yu's drawings. The monster mouth structure is one of the best preserved examples of this type of doorway, which was common in the late classic Rio-Bec architectural style in the nearby region to the south. The elaborate carving represents a Maya earth deity of fertility. Surrounding a doorway, it symbolizes the entrance to a cave and, in general, to the watery underworld, the mythological place of origin for maize and the abode of Maya ancestors. Sprake and his team also found remains of a number of massive palace-like buildings arranged around four major plazas. A ball court and a temple pyramid measuring almost 65 feet high also stood in the city, where 10 stelae and 3 altars featured well-preserved reliefs and hieroglyphic inscriptions. According to the preliminary reading by epigrapher Octavio Esparza Holguin from the National Autonomous University of Mexico, one of the stelae was engraved on November 29, AD 711, by someone referred to as a lord of 4 ka'atuns, or 20-year periods. Unfortunately, the remaining text, which includes the name of the ruler and possibly his wife, is heavily eroded. Judging from both the volume of architecture and the number of monuments with inscriptions, Lagunita must have been the seat of a relative powerful political structure, although the nature of its relationship with the larger Choctun, about 10 kilometers or 6 miles north, remains unclear. Just as imposing is the second city unearthed by Sprake. Previously unknown, the city was named Tamchen, meaning deep well, in Yucatec Maya. More than 30 choltuns came to light at the site. These are bottle-shaped underground chambers largely intended for collecting rainwater. Several choltuns were unusually deep, going down as far as 13 meters or more than 40 feet. As in Lagunita, large buildings surrounded plazas. These include the remains of an acropolis supporting a courtyard with 3 temples on its sides. Also unearthed were a pyramid temple with a very well-preserved sanctuary on top, and a stela and altar at its base. Tamchen appears to have been of the same era as Lagunita, although there is evidence for its settlement history going back to the late pre-classic, between AD 250 and 300. Both cities open new questions about the diversity of Maya culture, the role of that largely unexplored area in the lowland Maya history, and its relations with other cities. That wraps up the news for this week. For more stories and daily news updates, visit Archaeologica on the World Wide Web at archaeologica.org, where all the news is history. I'm Laura Pettigrew, and I'll see you next week.
This has been the audio news from Archaeologica, presented by the Archaeology Channel. Be sure to check back with us next week for our next edition. You can spread the word about the audio news by clicking on the Share This link on our audio news webpage, or just by telling your friends. Thanks very much for stopping by.
You're listening to Radio Newark.
This is the Engines of Our Ingenuity, made possible by the friends of KUHF Houston.
Today, we look under the surface of A Technical Meeting. The University of Houston's College of Engineering presents this series about the machines that make our civilization run and the people whose ingenuity created them. I'm in Berkeley, California, with 50 Japanese and American engineering scientists. These are the reigning experts on liquid vapor flows. We've met to talk about boiling, condensation, water hammer, explosive vaporization, and things like that. Behind it all is a shared interest in modern power equipment. How well these people wrestle with energy will decide your electric bill. They're the ones who avoid nuclear meltdowns. They'll eventually implement fusion power. So, graphs and schematic diagrams march across the screen, and no one exposes the least flicker of feeling for underlying drama. But drama is here. Consider the matter of size. If we yoked every person on Earth to treadmills, they'd sweat to match the output of one big power plant. We have to invent ways to move the power of thousands of toasters through areas the size of your desktop. We have to manipulate power on a scale so far beyond human capacity, we should be terrified. 12 years ago, a student and I modeled the accidental break of a hot water pipe in a nuclear reactor. Our flow area was only a thousandth of full size. The result was a mini explosion that shook the foundations of our building. Suddenly, we knew in our stomachs, not just our minds, what we were dealing with. Still, these people know that fear doesn't harness dragons. So we grind through 5 long days of nose-to-nose conversation. The Japanese and Americans struggle to understand each other's rules of politeness as they struggle to understand each other's equations and experiments. A Japanese engineer has worked with medical people. He uses magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, to measure steam water flows. We know MRI works in the human skull. Now he's made it work in a pipe. An American is trying to predict steam water flows with avant-garde ideas about chaos and fractals. Evening comes. I call my home to talk about the family and the household. I forget to mention what I found out today about a new hope for cold fusion. I, too, overlook the drama here. So what is happening in all this dry talk? These people are changing the quality and character of everyday life, but they only speak of numerical analysis, of experimental accuracy. They break the big picture into very small pieces. They hide their drama in a thicket of problems. One day, we'll live in a cleaner, safer world, and then, well, I know these people. When, like you and me, they enjoy that world, they'll quite overlook the part they played in building it. I'm John Leanhart at the University of Houston, where we're interested in the way inventive minds work.
Listen. At the tone, we've reached the top of the hour. WIZULP, Newark.
Bear Glasgow Dental in People's Plaza offers true sleep dentistry. Patients can be put under general anesthesia while remaining in the office. Family and general dentistry, cosmetic dentistry, and special needs dentistry are also available. There are 8 dentists with different specialties and native languages, including Chinese, Korean, and Spanish, which are spoken fluently. Find out more at their website, BearGlasgowDental.com.
Radio Newark News.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for November the 1st, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford. A fresh round of South California wildfires roared to life Thursday, destroying homes and forcing evacuations. That as the region faced a second day of explosively fierce Santa Ana winds that have fanned flames, displacing thousands of residents. That from Reuters. They report the most destructive among several new wind-driven blazes in the region erupted hours before dawn on the rugged slopes of the San Bernardino National Forest. Reuters adds a so-called hillside fire quickly devoured more than 200 acres and destroyed or damaged at least 6 homes. The open enrollment period for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act begins today, and healthcare advocates are advising people to read the fine print before deciding on a new policy.
Consumers for Quality Care sponsored a survey that found just over half of respondents said they understand very well their health insurance coverage for routine doctor visits. But according to board member Jason Resendez, only 22% said they understood what is covered for out-of-network hospital services or in the event of an accident.
It's really important for consumers to understand what exactly their plan covers and really thinking about how to avoid things like surprise medical bills.
The open enrollment period for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act ends on December 15th. Resendez particularly advises to watch out for short-term limited-duration insurance plans. He notes these low-cost plans are exempt from many of the coverage requirements of the Affordable Care Act and may leave people with huge medical bills. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey have already banned the sale of short-term limited-duration plans. New Mexico's oil and gas industry is currently providing the state's economy with a historic financial boost, but conservation groups worry about its transparency and whether a pledge to reduce methane emissions is sincere.
Lucas Herndon with Progress Now New Mexico says an out-of-state lobbying group called Power the Future is behind the Oil and Gas Association's messaging. He says environmentalists have been called radical by Power the Future's founder, which raises concerns about the group's agenda.
Who is this lobby group that's working in New Mexico on behalf of oil and gas companies and spending so much money and political will on influencing our state legislature and state government?
Prior to her election in 2016, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham promised to expand the state's oil-dependent economy, but recently told industry leaders she hopes New Mexico can overtake North Dakota as the nation's number 2 oil producer while also designing new regulations for methane emissions. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
This is PNS. This week, more than 250 conservatives from Wyoming and 43 other states, including Republican State Representative Jared Olson of Cheyenne, signed a statement calling for an end to the death penalty.
The move comes as the Trump administration plans to resume federal executions. Kylie Taylor, with the Wyoming chapter of Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty, calls capital punishment a wasteful, ineffective, and error-prone government program that goes against core conservative principles.
Republican state lawmakers are introducing legislation to repeal the death penalty. It's very expensive. It's a failed government program, and it doesn't value life.
Taylor says as soon as prosecutors announce they'll seek the death penalty, cost to taxpayers can increase by as much as 10 times the cost of lesser sentences. Proponents of the death penalty say it's an important deterrent and that jurors should have an option to impose what many see as a just and appropriate sentence for the worst crimes committed. I'm Eric Galatis.
While many Washingtonians with felony convictions had their voting rights restored a decade ago, barriers and confusion remain. Democratic Senator Patty Coorer of Bellevue wants to allow people in community custody, known as on parole, to vote.
I don't think that taking away someone's right to vote fits the crime. And I say that because there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that taking away someone's right to vote has a deterrent effect on the commission of crime.
Coroner notes restrictions on voting rights.